Your member of Congress might be home in the district this week, unless your name is, perhaps, Pelosi, Schiff, McCarthy, Nunes, McConnell. The list goes on. Meanwhile, a second whistleblower has come forward. On Insight, political reporter Kate Irby joins us from Washington, D.C. with some of the latest conversations she's had with members of the California delegation and her recent story that was focused on Devin Nunes. Also today, Tommy Orange and his debut novel, There, There. It's a book that won a long list of awards and fans all over the world. Tommy's Native American. He grew up in Oakland. He now lives in Angels Camp. You'll hear part of our Cap Radio Reads conversation from last month. And on the subject of reading, how are kids reading this year in Sacramento County? April Javist from the Library Foundation shares the latest results of the Community Literacy Map. I'm Beth Ruyak. That's today on Insight. From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Beth Ruyak. Another whistleblower came forward in the Trump-Ukraine story, and this happened over the weekend when many members of Congress were back in their home districts for a two-week recess. Let's start the hour with D.C. congressional reporter for McClatchy, Kate Irby. She's joining us by phone from Washington, D.C. Still there, you are, Kate. Good morning.
Hi there.
So tell me how the news is moving today regarding the second whistleblower.
So it's definitely pretty crazy in D.C. You know, you've got this this drip where every single thing is, like, coming out, and it's happening quickly. So second whistleblower is obviously an example of that. Now it's not just one, it's at least two. And the lawyers are also saying that they just say that they would now represent multiple whistleblowers. So they're not even limiting it to just two. So we will probably be hearing more about this as time goes on.
I know you don't really know the answer to this, but it's worth asking how the identities of the whistleblowers have stayed secret in a city where it seems that nothing stays secret for long.
Well, I mean, I think the intelligence committee or intelligence community hopefully knows how to keep the secret better than most people in D.C. And obviously, Democrats want to keep this under wraps. They don't want any retaliation. And hopefully Republicans feel that way about the actual whistleblower process as well. Even if some of them feel that this is partisan, there's still a lot of hope in the whistleblower system generally that needs to be preserved.
Some key members of the California delegation are at the center in the spotlight of the impeachment inquiry, Nancy Pelosi, and the investigation into the whistleblower case, Adam Schiff. Tell me about the communication between them and the rest of the delegation. What's the reaction to the intensity of the positions they've taken and the words they've been speaking lately?
So as of now, I think Speaker Pelosi is trying to handle this by not having regular members go on the record yet. Republicans have been pushing this narrative that the House needs to take a vote first just to authorize the impeachment inquiry, and that Speaker Pelosi has not done that. That's likely because Speaker Pelosi does not want her members going on the record as supporting impeachment until they know exactly what the allegations are. So that's how she's kind of been protecting her, especially her purple district, people like Representative Hart or Representative Cox in California. Most Californians, even purple district ones of the delegation, came out supporting at least an impeachment inquiry, if not an impeachment vote, the day that impeachment was announced. So it seems like generally they're all supportive of this and that they're moving in a way that they're hoping to cut down on any political implications.
What's the reaction been to Adam Schiff and his handling of the committee hearing, which was watched across the country, but within the California delegation, what are you hearing?
So, you know, you have a lot of Republicans going after Representative Schiff, particularly Representative Nunes, who's in California, obviously, about his what so-called parody in that committee hearing. Representative Schiff took the call, and he was kind of imitating Trump's style, but he was saying things that were not actually in the Ukraine call, and then later said it was a parody, or his staff said it was a parody. Republicans really went after him on that. Representative Nunes has said that's no way to be conducting an investigation, and that's basically lying about what was going on in the conversation. But Representative Nunes has also gone back and forth on criticizing Representative Schiff about this should be public. Oh, no, this should be private. No, this should be public again. So the problem for Representative Schiff is obviously every single move he makes is going to be highly scrutinized, especially by Republicans. And so any little misstep that happens, then he is going to get reamed over.
Kate, you have a story in the Fresno Bee that was published last week about Devin Nunes, and you wrote, Nunes has long been one of Trump's closest allies in Congress and served on Trump's presidential transition team after the 2016 election. Talk about how he's been defending the president during this time of the impeachment inquiry.
So Representative Nunes is a frequent appearance on Fox News, especially Fox News commentator shows, which if your listeners don't know, those are very, very highly watched, like Hannity, Tucker Carlson, Laura Ingraham. And these are commentators who say that they, you know, they are conservative. They are not going to push conservative appearances like Representative Nunes by challenging their assertions. They're going to mostly agree with them and further the Republican stance. So generally, Representative Nunes has been going on those types of shows, criticizing Representative Schiff, saying that this is the Russia hoax 2.0, that Democrats are just desperate to impeach Trump and they're trying to use anything that they can to get there, and trying to also poke holes in the investigation itself, questioning the integrity of the investigators, the integrity of the whistleblower complaint process, anything he can to kind of sow some doubt among fellow Republicans that this impeachment inquiry is anything but legitimate.
I need a basic civics lesson here, Kate. So Nunes was a member of the majority party and in charge of the House Intelligence Committee. He's now a member of the minority party. If he was still in charge and Republicans were in the majority, would there have been choice about convening the committee meeting we saw last week? Is there enough pressure that would have had to happen beyond any partisanship in the decision?
It might have still happened. There obviously would have been some pressure. It's hard to say in this current political environment, though. You've had Republicans who have really circled the wagons kind of around Trump and have a lot of them, including Representative McCarthy, who is now the minority leader and would have possibly been the speaker if Republicans had the majority. He's been a pretty vociferous ally to Trump. So you might have still had the hearing. It almost certainly would not have been anything to do with actual impeachment. There just might have still been an investigation into this whistleblower complaint. It also could be conducted very differently because when you are in the majority party, you have subpoena power, whereas the minority party does not. So Democrats have already subpoenaed the White House. They've made it clear that they're not waiting on these types of things. They're going to play ball. And you could pretty much guarantee that Republicans would not have taken that step.
I'm talking with Kate Irby. She covers the California congressional delegation from Washington, D.C. for McClatchy. Any other conversations that you've had with members of the California delegation? And you mentioned Representative Cox, and I'm just wondering about the pacing there in deciding to support an impeachment inquiry.
Sure. So Representative Cox was, I believe, the last one in the California delegation to sign on to the impeachment inquiry. And he actually waited until after Speaker Pelosi said that it was happening before he came out and said that he supported it. And he's probably one of the, if not the most at-risk Democrat in California. He is one of them. For viewers of yours who don't know, or readers of listeners of yours that don't know, he only won by less than 1,000 votes, and he actually didn't even know for sure that he had won until months after the election. So he's being very, very cautious in how he handles this. He's in a purple district. He doesn't want to alienate independent voters. So we'll see how this progresses from here. Right now, he and other members who are being more cautious only say that they support an inquiry, whereas other members have already said, you know, if these allegations are true, I support a vote. I want to vote on impeachment. So if you hear the word inquiry, that they support the investigation of the inquiry, those are the people who are generally being a little bit more cautious.
Any names to put in that cautious category?
Like I said, Representative Cox. I believe Representative Cisneros is in the same one. He's also a freshman Democrat who was new over to that. But basically, like any purple district Democrats, Representative Katie Hill, things like that, they are a little bit more cautious generally.
I've said a couple times that you cover the California delegation, but being so close, I know you keep your eye a little bit on what's happening in Nevada. Anything to add in there in terms of what you've observed?
So we have a representative over there who is a Republican who made some headlines last week because he said on a call that he we'll see what happens, he was saying, on the impeachment inquiry. You know, he didn't denounce it. He made it seem like he was going to wait and see what was going on in the actual investigation before he weighed in one way or the other. So he got some heat from that because you have Republicans who really are trying to stay together on messaging right now. There's been other reporting that has suggested, especially after Representative McCarthy made an appearance on 60 Minutes, where it was generally seen as just not a great performance, that he wasn't on message, his defense of President Trump was not convincing, and you've heard that Republicans are kind of struggling on what exactly their messaging should be right now. And I think that Nevada representative was an example of that they're just not completely unified on messaging at this moment.
Last week on this program, every day we approached this topic of California's state of resistance from different angles. And a press release was sent out late last week that California Senators Kamala Harris and Dianne Feinstein are asking the EPA's Inspector General to investigate the White House's role in the EPA's attacks on California and the city of San Francisco. How vivid is this idea, this atmosphere of this state's state of resistance?
I mean, yeah, it's basically been a constant back and forth between President Trump and his administration in the state of California. As you mentioned, we've seen that with the EPA. We saw it when President Trump came to California and all of a sudden was saying all these things about homelessness when he really hadn't weighed into the issue before. And you had people in California who are affordable housing advocates who disagreed with the way that he was characterizing the way to fix this problem. And now that he's back in impeachment, that seems to have faded a little bit. But he also called Governor Newsom do nothing in a press conference that was about impeachment. So it's continuous. It always seems to be going on. I'm sure it doesn't help that, as you've pointed out, Speaker Pelosi, Representative Adam Schiff, people who are running point on this impeachment investigation are all from California. So President Trump seems to increasingly think that California is more of an opponent than an ally, and he keeps going after them.
So one more question, Kate, and that is, we started this by making the point that members of Congress, those who aren't in those key roles, are back in their home districts. And I wonder what they're going to be hearing from people. I wonder whether impeachment inquiry is on top of mind or whether the discussions are going to be to health care or immigration or some of the other key issues that might directly impact their lives. What do you think?
All right. So I'm working on a story on that right now, actually. It seems that for the most part, and I haven't completely confirmed this yet, but for the most part, that these town halls are really not focused on impeachment. Democrats especially have really capitalized on this aspect of a town hall because when they unseated Republicans, those seven, like Representative Harder, Representative Cox, they always were talking about how they weren't having town halls. They weren't listening to their constituents. So Harder and Cox have made it kind of a staple of their offices that they're going to keep having town halls. And they're in their districts right now, as you pointed out. It doesn't sound like at these town halls impeachment has really been coming up very often, if at all. So, you know, people on the ground, you know, even though it's driving D.C. crazy and everyone's in a spin in D.C., on the ground, people, you know, they care about issues that affect their wallets. They care about health care. They care about jobs. They want to hear about these things from their representative more than they want to hear about impeachment.
All right, Kate, it's always a pleasure to start the week with you. This is a to-be-continued conversation for sure. So thanks for joining us from Washington, D.C.
Pleasure being here. Thank you.
That was Kate Irby, political reporter for McClatchy. Last week, I do want to add that in Nevada, CAP Radio reporter Bert Johnson had a moment to talk with former Vice President Joe Biden, who was on the campaign trail. We thought we'd share just a little bit of that conversation that did have to do specifically with the Trump-Ukraine case.
It's been an eventful 2 weeks for you. The U.S. House might investigate President Donald Trump for a call he made to the Ukrainian president asking to investigate you and your son. The president upped his rhetoric recently, calling you and your son crooks. How do you respond to that?
Everybody knows who Donald Trump is, and I don't have to respond to anything. There's not a single outlet in the world that I'm aware of that has done anything other than say there's not a single solitary thing either my son or I did wrong, number one. Number two, this is about Donald Trump. He's the one that has to answer the questions. So I'm not going to let him divert and try to make this about me. And there's no basis for anything he said.
That was Joe Biden talking last week with CAP Radio reporter Bert Johnson. Up next, you're going to hear my conversation with Tommy Orange. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. There There is the astonishing, award-winning, and best-selling novel by Tommy Orange, who grew up in Oakland but lives now with his wife and 7-year-old son in the foothills of Angels Camp, California. This novel is his first. It's a book that he says he actually just wanted to have published so that he could get a teaching job. But this book has done so much more than that. The story unfolds with an ensemble of about a dozen main characters, young and old, boys and girls, men and women. Some are native, some are non-native, and their lives are woven together in ways that aren't made clear until a final climactic and violent scene that unfolds at a powwow at the Oakland Coliseum. Tommy was here in September for a CAP Radio Reads event, which I guest hosted for Donna Appadoni. Our conversation was recorded before a live audience. Today, you are going to hear part of that before the podcast version of that night is released. I started by asking Tommy why he thinks his book has captivated people everywhere so intensely.
I hate that the first place my mind goes around this question is Trump, but it's totally related because he's made people make the decision about what do they value and who do they side with and what do they want to do about it. And the book sold right after Standing Rock was a big thing. Native people aren't in national attention very often, but it's always when we have been in a major way, it's always been followed by a boom in interest ever since the first Native American literary renaissance, in which we took over Alcatraz and Marlon Brando had Sashi and Littlefeather not accept the Academy Award. Mm-hmm. That was the first boom. And then there was a lot of attention, then not that much. And then in the 90s, Dances with Wolves won a lot of awards, and that had the same effect. And so Standing Rock and Trump, like, these are factors that I can't help but think of. Of course, I'm not just going to be like the merit of my work. It's not the case. A lot of amazing books come out every year. A lot are missed. A lot are found later. Our times, the political times, and having people want to listen more to marginal voices. And I think that's the main thing. I mean, I have a lot of other weird side theories I'm not going to get into, but
why not? Give me one.
Well, it's different for each country too, because it's been translated into like 24 different languages. And I was just in Germany, and they have kind of their own weird interest in native people. And it's doing well there. So they had a guy named Karl May, who's a novelist, who had never been to America and never met a native person. And he sold like 40 million books. And so it was like a reverse of Tonto and Lone Ranger. It was Winnetou, and I don't know what the sidekick was, but he was a white cowboy. And the main guy was Winnetou, he was a native guy out of Karl May's imagination. And everyone loved native people because of growing up reading these stories. So the theory for German people is that's related to this very specific thing. I don't want to necessarily get into any of my side theories.
You said something about a renaissance, and there are people calling you the new native renaissance. How does that play to you? What does that mean?
I don't love it, because the renaissance has always meant like a resurgence in interest in native people and matters, and then it's like a trend that dies off, and I would rather have a sustainable interest in what is our country's relationship to the people who were here before, and what is our national identity, and how does it relate to how we ended up a nation? That should be a lasting way that we reimagine who we are as Americans. Our relationship to the people who were here and how we acquired the land and all that we did should be a lasting formation of the American identity, and not some like romanticized thing that we can think of sometimes when we're like, oh, what are they doing again? And then go back to thinking that we don't exist anymore.
Did the concept of the book come to you in sort of a moment, sort of an idea, and then unfolded from there?
It did. It was maybe a couple of weeks after I found out I was going to be a father, and we were, me and my wife were driving to LA to see this very crazy rapper and pianist named Chilly Gonzalez. And as a lot of great ideas can come from not thinking, this sort of like popped into my head, this idea of having all these lives converge at a powwow at the Oakland Coliseum. And I just became convinced by that premise. And powwows are such a great place for an urban Indian story to be told, because they're contemporary and traditional feeling, and they're intertribal. And there's just there's a lot of resonance for the urban Indian to be told in that context. And then for it to be Oakland and Oakland Coliseum, I'd also known that I wanted to write a novel about Oakland, because there's not that much out there.
Had you been to a powwow before?
My dad is full-blood Cheyenne from Oklahoma, grew up in a rural town, small town, and he didn't grow up going to powwows, so he didn't really raise us going. We went to a few in my childhood, and one memorable one when I was 18, I don't know why he took us randomly, to one in Berkeley at a gymnasium. Well, I guess this is why, because the kid I grew up with, we only grew up with one other Indian family in Oakland, and they were the Browns. And us being the Oranges, I knew there was some connection to last name in Indian families, but I knew there had to be something else to it. And you know, he never had a good explanation as to why we were the Oranges.
That was going to be one of my questions. Where did that last name come from?
It's a Cheyenne name, but there's a lot of mysteries to last names when it comes to colonization and black people and tribal people who don't have a history of last names and surnames and patriarchy embedded in the same way into their culture. So it's a sordid history, and there's a lot of different reasons why last names would end up kind of weird. And so I don't know what ours is. At one point in kindergarten, my mom has orange hair, and we had an orange van at the time. We would get dropped off two blocks from school because my sisters were mortified by the idea of being the Oranges and being... And I didn't care. I mean, I was in kindergarten.
You didn't care. So you were little.
I wasn't. Yeah.
Do you have a native name?
Yeah. My dad gave us all Cheyenne names. So mine translates as birds sing in the morning. A not very good Cheyenne version of that, because we didn't grow up speaking my language, is Vigas Maonistos. So he just woke up one morning very early and was inspired to name me that.
There There was a finalist for the 2019 Pulitzer Prize. It recently won the 2019 American Book Award, as well as the 2019 Penn Hemingway Award. It won the 2018 National Book Critics Circle John Leonard Prize, and the 2019 Center for Fiction First Novel Prize. Also, it won a gold medal for first fiction by the California Book Awards. There There was a finalist for the 2019 Andrew Carnegie Medal for Excellence in Fiction. It was longlisted for the National Book Award. And it is a finalist for the Dayton Literary Peace Prize, which will be awarded November 3rd.
Thank you.
What is this book for Native people? What are you hearing back?
Well, it's just like a modern depiction is hungry for there being no contemporary modern depictions that get popular attention, I think, is a combination of those things. Because there are a lot of people doing modern cool stuff in the Native world, but the attention doesn't happen. So my book's gotten a lot of attention, and that means there can be a shift in the way people think about Native people, and it can stop being so static and so historical and so monolithic, and it can have a range, because the book has a range of proximities to Native identity, and it's definitively contemporary, and that's just not something we've been allowed in the popular consensus and the way people think of Native people. And we're not so worried about what people think of Native people, except that we've been defined by the outside world so much, and this affects policies, and this affects the way we live our lives. So we have to be at least paying attention to what the world thinks of us. We have to.
If you would read this passage, this is from the prologue, which is a whole setting of power in and of itself. I think your use of the prologue is something that, for you personally as a writer, is an important part of structure.
Well, I knew I wanted to write a prologue before I knew what I wanted it to be about. And then once I, because prologues can break all the rules of whatever world you set up once you start the world of the novel. Prologues can be anything. And this is why I knew I wanted to write one. And so once I realized I wanted to write about sort of like an urban Native contextual manifesto of like, what does it mean and where does it come from? Because it feels so absent in literature. It brought me through history and my own personal hearing of my dad's stories, and then eventually this Indian head theme and this finding on the internet of a telling of this Cheyenne story, this traditional old Cheyenne story that's very strange. My grandpa, who I never met, I found it on the internet. It's his telling of it that I incorporated into the prologue.
Really?
But this is the part that you asked me, right? When they first came for us with their bullets, we didn't stop moving, even though the bullets moved twice as fast as the sound of our screams. And even when their heat and speed broke our skin, shattered our bones, skulls pierced our hearts, we kept on. Even when we saw the bullets send our bodies flailing through the air like flags, like the many flags and buildings that went up in place of everything we knew this land to be before. The bullets were premonitions, ghosts from dreams of a hard, fast future. The bullets moved on after moving through us, became the promise of what was to come, the speed and the killing, the hard, fast lines of borders and buildings. They took everything and ground it down to dust as fine as gunpowder. They fired their guns into the air in victory, and strays flew out into the nothingness of histories written wrong and meant to be forgotten.
How young is too young to learn and read this? Is this book now in high schools, or have you heard from high school teachers yet?
I went to a high school in Wisconsin, and this teacher had sort of pushed through some grant to get the money for the book, and she made it happen for her high school. And I've heard of other similar stories, so it's definitely happening in high schools. And that same teacher, I went, it was my first high school event, and I'm so scared of high schoolers. The first thing I want to say when I get offered by my lecture agent, like, this high school wants you to come, I'm like, no, no.
Why?
The high schoolers are scary.
It wasn't so long ago for you.
It was like 20 years ago. No, but I always dread them, and then they're like the best events. Mm. So a kid, a native kid from a visit to a Wisconsin high school didn't speak up and wanted to because he felt just too shy or whatever. She sent a note from him in an email. He would never even would have thought that he would see himself on the page of stuff to read in school. And he said it changed him as a reader, and that he'll never be the same kind of student again because he was able to find himself in the books. And that was, you know, that was an amazing moment for me. And so I keep doing high school things because of that. But it's scary every time.
How do you feel this book changing you and your family with your wife and your son, and what the horizon for your life might be?
I don't know. I mean, right now it feels very practical. Like, I thought I'd be a renter my whole life, and we just bought a house. And that, you know, that's a crazy change in reality. We no longer have to worry about money, which is my lifetime relationship to money was just being worried about it. That's like a really nice thing. It's a very serious change in the way that you think about the day to day and what's next month and will we have a place to live? Can we pay rent? These are like, you know, a lot of stress relievers. In terms of what it means that I'm like some kind of known author, it's still too early to tell what it will do, if it's going to be like damaging or good. I don't know. I would hope my son would eventually, it would be a good thing, but fame and success don't always do that to people. So I try to stay grounded in like running and spending time with family and continuing to write, and if I can do all those things, I know I can stay in a good place.
So your story is to be continued.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Thank you all for coming on.
Author Tommy Orange in September of 2019, talking about his award-winning, best-selling debut novel, There, There. And whether you are a constant reader or rarely a reader, this is a book not to miss, or you can listen to it as an audiobook. And you can hear more of our conversation in the Cap Radio Reads podcast episode, which isn't up yet, but will be posted soon. And here's a bonus bit of information. Tommy told us that night that the TV series rights have been bought by what he called a big company that I can't reveal yet, with a director who is Native American. He said there's still a long journey for the production to end up on TV, but he said it would be amazing to have that happen. Tommy Orange, his debut novel from 2018 is There, There. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. This is Insight on Cap Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. Summer reading programs and other literacy providers can have positive outcomes for young readers. They certainly can lessen what's known as the summer slide. But until last year, no one in Sacramento County was gathering data in one place and assessing it. Now, the Library Foundation, led by Executive Director April Javist, is tracking the reading levels at schools through the county through a variety of measuring tools, including summer reading. The first community literacy map was created and released in 2018. April's back today with, shall we say, the report card and second-year results. Hi, April.
Hi, Beth. Thanks
Glad
for having me.
Glad to have you back
me.
In the
Thank
studio.
You.
We have a young reader here with us, too, Anaya McLeod.
Hello.
Hi,
yes.
Anaya.
Hi.
How old are you?
I'm 15.
Can I ask what book you're in the midst of or about to start right now?
Right now, I'm actually starting Jurassic Park for my honors biology in school.
Ah, that's that. And where do you go to school?
I'm homeschooled. I actually go to Visions in Education, and I'm in the university prep program.
Okay, well, glad to have you here today.
Thank you.
April, the first year's literacy map confirmed that 3 out of 5 kids were not reading at grade level.
That's right.
And you also looked at how individual schools were doing right. There was mm-hmm. not a single school that had 95% of kids reading right. at grade level.
I think maybe there was one, which is West Campus
okay.
High School. It's a high school down there in South Sac that that you have to apply to get into. You have to be a top student. And I believe that they have the highest reading rate. I was looking at that, and I think they got across 95% this year.
So how much change did you see, and how much change really can there be year to year in terms of reading levels?
Well, year to year, it's a slow road uphill. This year, we saw a 6% increase in third grade reading levels, and that translated into an overall 2% increase in grade level reading for Sacramento. So right now, we still have more kids not reading at grade level than reading at grade level. And we have 54% of our kids who need that help, and we have 46% of our kids who are reading at grade level. So we're getting on that 50-50 line. Now, that's taken a lot of people, a lot of organizations, and it's slow. It's been a slow road. We've been at this for 10 years now, and we've moved the needle about 11%.
Hmm. I want to go back to third grade.
Yeah.
That's a critical mm-hmm. year. Students may not realize it. A lot of parents might not realize it. But what do we see at third grade, and why are you targeting that right. year?
Third grade has been targeted nationally because we, in the education world, we educate children up to the third grade. We teach them how to read. But at the fourth grade, we expect them to know how to read, and they need to read to learn. So they learn to read to the third grade, and then they read to learn after that.
I've had third grade teachers tell me that whatever did or didn't happen in first and second grade with the mm-hmm. basics
yeah.
will really show itself in third grade.
Well, I'm coming across some new information from a colleague in the literacy movement that we're working on building who has pointed out that there's a lot of research out there. Elise Spang from the Central Valley Foundation, she's pointed out that there's a lot of research out there that says 1 out of 3 brains will pick up reading without any kind of help. But 2 out of 3 brains need a little more of a roadmap, irregardless of their intelligence. So that's what we're talking about. Kindergarten, first grade, second grade, those roadmaps need to be in place. And we haven't figured that out in curriculum. But we do know it's true. This has been interesting for me to find out.
Anaya, what kind of a reader are you? How many books do you go through? What'd you do in the summer with your reading?
So when I was doing summer reading this year, I finished about like more than 10, I know for sure, but like I finished a lot and I didn't even get to get my free book because I completely forgot about it at the end. But it was okay because, you know, all that matters is that I got to experience reading and I don't need a free book. Like, it's okay, you know? It was all right.
April needs to explain the free book here.
Yeah.
The foundation funds the library's summer reading program and, in particular, the prizes. So when a young person reads 5 books, they get a free book at the end of that and a chance to enter into a drawing where they can win a bigger prize. And every 5 books they read, they can get a free book. So the library owes you 2 free books.
There you go. And the effort is always made to recruit schools and then recruit individual students to join summer reading throughout mm-hmm. the county.
Yeah.
So Anaya, do you remember when you were young and learning to read first,
yes.
second? You do?
Yeah.
All right. Tell me how old you were and tell me what your memories are.
Well, my love for words in general started when I was, I think, in the months of my age, because my grandma would teach me words every day, a new word every day, and then I would memorize it and then have to, like, use it in a sentence for the day. And she taught me Spanish and the ABCs and numbers. And then I just, like, ever since then, I just started to love words. And so that made me love reading. And when I was in, I remember when I was in, like, I started writing my own books when I was in fifth or sixth grade. Mm. And it just expanded even more because I wanted my writing to be as good as all the books that I've read. And so I looked up words and I expanded my vocabulary and it helped me become the person I am today.
Did you say months of your age?
Yes, meaning, like months, yes. When I was like in my months.
Under 1 year old?
Yes, under one.
Wow. And you're the oldest of four girls, right?
Oldest of five girls,
oh,
yes.
Gosh. Is everybody a reader?
Well, let's see. So I am a reader. My two other sisters are readers, but the youngest ones, they're starting to read. Like they're kind of drama. They like all the drama stuff about life. Like they don't really pay attention to reading that much.
So either there was different one-on-one attention
yeah.
to you and the others in learning reading, or maybe this is some of the statistic you were talking about, yeah. April. It's hard to know, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, I think it is hard to know, but I do think that what we do know is that if we give people that roadmap, we can get a 95% success rate. We do know that, too. So I think it's about figuring out how to get this all instituted.
What do you think makes the difference, Anaya, as your world goes on and there are a lot of distractions,
yeah.
most of them on your smartphone, but there are a lot of reasons not to be reading a book.
Yeah. Well, I think in this time, it's becoming harder for like teens and even kids to read because it seems like no one is focusing on it as much as they should. Like they're not teaching about reading. Like it's crazy because they're not teaching about all of the words that you should know. Like kids are just focusing on a bunch of technology, and I think that's what happened with my younger sisters because they love the TV, but when you try and sit and read to them, their eyes wander, they don't focus on what you're saying, and I think that has a lot to do with that.
Are you talking about the difference between vocabulary and expanded language versus the language that you need to understand pop culture or be on Facebook or post an Instagram?
Yes, that's very different because when you're online, they have that slang. They use abbreviations. They don't use full words. They come up with new words to learn, and that's what kids are learning now. They're not learning the actual words of the world. They're learning these new words of the internet.
That's 15-year-old Anaya McLeod. She is homeschooled. She is talking with us about reading in general and a love for reading. April Javist is the executive director of the Sacramento County Library Foundation. And Sacramento County is recognizing that this mm-hmm. literacy move is happening. And by the way, we'll talk in a moment about the Walk for Literacy. But tell me how you've engaged people outside of literary circles.
Mm-hmm. So when Dave Lawrence came to Authors on the Move last year, we invited him to meet with folks in the literacy community about how we might think about building a literacy movement, because he had built a children's movement in Florida. And so he sat with us generously on that Sunday, and about 40 of us were in the room, librarians, politicians, philanthropists, providers, and students, lots of different kinds of people, and also folks from SCOE. And we sat and talked about how we might create a literacy movement together. And Council Member Eric Guerra suggested that we find a way to proclaim a literacy day. And we engaged the politicians that way. So we did. We made September 8th Literacy Day, which is in line with International Literacy Day, which we felt made good sense for Sacramento, being so international. And September's Literacy Month. So we just had Literacy Month last month. And what it's done is it's brought attention to the elected officials that this is an issue. So that's been helpful, I think. So to your point, Anaya, it does matter to start talking about it. And that's what the movement is for, is to start talking about, well, more kids can't read than can. And we must do something about that.
SCOE is the Sacramento County Office of Education.
Yes.
And some of the factors that are taken into account in establishing reading levels include school lunch, for example. Mm-hmm. And this second report card shows more of the correlation between reading and eating lunch.
Yeah. We did a standalone research piece to see if not reading at grade level was correlated to free and reduced meal program eligibility. And in fact, it's strongly correlated. So kids who are eligible for free and reduced meal program lunches are less likely to be readers. It turns out, Beth, reading and not reading is almost correlated to everything good and bad. It's that important.
You can walk for literacy. That's coming up later this month. And get your team together. And at the finish line, there's a big book festival. So this is about as family-friendly as it can be.
Yeah, all the literacy providers will be there. Sac State is hosting the festival. We're so excited. They're such a good sponsor that way. And we've got lots of people walking from McClatchy Park to Sac State. It's 4 miles. And we sure would like more people to join us and let our politicians know that this is important to all of us. We've got a lot of high school kids engaged. Vision in Education is one of our sponsors. And when I met Anaya, I was like, that's a great fit. She's helping build a team there. And it'd be great to see high school kids coming out. This is their issue. This is their equity issue. This is the thing that they can do something about as they become young adults.
The walk is Saturday, October 26th. It starts at McClatchy Park. We'll post a link if you want to register online, or you can register the day of the event. Now to the world around you, Anaya, and how reading is making a difference. And do you notice gaps when you get together, either in the atmosphere of teenagers in general or in particular homeschooled kids?
Yeah, so I think there's a gaps, you say? Gaps?
I just wondered if you observe gaps or different levels of the ability to read. It's not necessarily something other teenagers would pay attention to.
Yeah, okay. So, like, you mean that? I'm sorry. I'm so sorry.
Well, answer this in whatever way you want. At the high school level, how much is reading making a difference in your world?
Okay. Reading changes my world, like, so much. Like, It helps me have a distraction. Like, I know that other people could turn to different things for distraction, other things that would harm them more. But reading actually, like, really helps me. And I think that more people should turn to that because they would find themselves in, like, a whole new different world of their own, and they could experience their own imagination starting to just blow up with all these different scenarios in the books. And, like, that's what happens to me every time.
Are you a library fan? Do you and your sisters go to the library
we
for books?
We get so excited when we get to go to the library. We go about twice a month, maybe more.
Okay.
Yeah.
And what's your goal after high school? Or do you have a goal in high school as you finish?
Yes, I have a goal in high school. I want to get straight A's for every year of high school.
Wow. And so far, so good?
Yes. Yes. I've got straight A's last year. And so far, I have straight A's right now.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
And then what? Do you have a career in mind?
Yes. I would want to become a counseling psychologist or a child social worker because I love helping people.
Well, everybody can take a look at their school in the Sacramento County and even outside of the county to see how literacy is being mapped. Again, the link will provide this color-coded map. You want to explain a little bit?
Yeah, it's at communityliteracymap.org, and it has every school on the map. It is inside of Sacramento County, and what it does is it takes the CASP scores for English, and it puts them on the map per school. It also has all the literacy providers on the map. It has all the libraries on the map. It has the schools that are engaged in summer reading on the map. It has elected officials on the map. It has districts, school districts, SCOE districts. So no matter who you are, if you are interested in literacy, if you're a parent, you're a kid, you're a philanthropist, you're a politician or a policymaker, this map is going to be helpful to you.
Very well said. Thank you both for this conversation.
Thank you, Beth. It was so nice to be here again. Thank you.
Good luck with the Walk for Literacy on October 26th. So we'll post a link to see the map. Also, we'll post a link to last year's conversation, which laid a lot of groundwork for what you plan to do.
Yeah, it did. Thank you.
Good luck, Anaya, with your straight A goals. I want to hear a report back as you're going to graduate from high school. We'll also post a link to registration for the walk on October 26th. And again, that was Anaya McLeod and April Javist. And that's Insight for today. I'm Beth Ruyak. Insight is produced by Helen Barrington, Kate Gonzalez, and Cody Drabble. Our digital team is Chris Hagan and Emily Zentner. Our website, by the way, is capradio.org/insight. Our technical director is Mark Jones. Our engineer is Antonio Munez. Insight's managing editor is Aram Sarkissian. And our executive producer is Joe Barr. Thanks for joining us.